but they did not land the same way on the minds of all present. Some were eager to obey, filled with something close to pleasure at the thought that death was a fine thing, while others, softer in spirit, were overcome with pity for their wives and children, and, looking at each other and at their own plainly foreseeable end, showed by their tears how unwilling they were. Seeing them losing heart and their spirits bending under the weight of the proposal, Eleazar feared that their wailing and tears would soften even those who had heard his words with resolve. So he did not let up his exhortation, but rousing himself and filling himself with great spirit, he turned to loftier arguments about the immortality of the soul, and with a great cry of protest, staring fixedly at those who were weeping, he said, "How greatly I was deceived in believing I was joining brave men in the struggle for freedom, men resolved to live nobly or else to die. But you are no different from ordinary men, neither in courage nor in daring, you who fear even the death that would free you from the greatest evils, when for this you ought neither to hesitate nor to wait for anyone's advice. From the very first stirrings of understanding, the teachings of our fathers and our sacred teachings have instructed us, confirmed by the deeds and convictions of our ancestors, that life, not death, is the calamity for men. For death gives the soul its freedom and lets it depart to its own pure home to be free of every calamity, untouched thereafter. Whereas so long as souls are bound within a mortal body and share in its afflictions, in the truest sense of the word, they are already dead. For fellowship between the divine and the mortal is unfitting. Great, indeed, is the power of the soul even while it is bound to the body, for it turns the body into an instrument of perception, moving it invisibly and, through its actions, carrying it beyond the limits of its mortal nature. But once it is released from the weight that drags it down and clings to it toward the earth, and regains its own proper place, then it partakes of blessed strength and power unhindered on every side, remaining invisible to human eyes, just as God himself is. Indeed, even while the soul is in the body, it cannot be seen. It arrives unseen and departs again unseen, having a single incorruptible nature of its own, yet becoming the cause of change in the body. Whatever the soul touches lives and flourishes, whatever it leaves withers and dies, so great is the measure of immortality that belongs to it. Let sleep serve you as the clearest proof of what I say. In sleep, when the body no longer distracts them, souls enjoy their sweetest rest, being left to themselves, and communing with God by kinship, they range everywhere and foretell many things that are yet to come. Why then should we fear death when we love the rest that comes in sleep? And how is it not senseless, while pursuing freedom in this life, to begrudge ourselves the everlasting kind? Trained as we are at home in such things, we ought to be an example to others of readiness for death. But if we need confirmation from foreigners as well, let us look to the Indians, who profess to practice wisdom. For those men, good men that they are, endure the span of their lives unwillingly, as a kind of service owed to nature, but hasten to free their souls from their bodies. And though no pressing evil drives or expels them, out of longing for the immortal way of life, they announce to the others beforehand that they mean to depart, and no one tries to stop them, rather, everyone counts them fortunate and gives them letters, each for their own dead relatives. Such is their confidence that the fellowship of souls with one another beyond is a sure and truest way of life. And once they have listened to the messages entrusted to them, they give their body to the fire, so as to release the soul from the body in its purest state and die amid hymns of praise. Their dearest kin send them off to death more easily than other people send their fellow citizens on the longest of journeys. They weep for themselves, but count those departing blessed, now that they are receiving their place among the immortals. Are we then not ashamed to think worse than the Indians, and through our own cowardice to disgrace the laws of our fathers, laws that all mankind envies? But even if from the start we had been taught the opposite doctrine, that life is the greatest good for men and death a calamity, still the present moment calls on us to bear it bravely, dying by God's will and under compulsion. For it seems that long ago God cast this vote against the whole community of the Jewish nation, that we should be freed from life, since we were not going to make right use of it. So do not blame yourselves for this, and do not give the Romans the credit of having destroyed us all in this war. It was not their strength that brought this about, but a greater cause that made it merely appear they had won. For by what Roman weapons did the Jews living in Caesarea die? They had not even considered revolting from Rome, but while they were in the midst of keeping the Sabbath, the mass of the people of Caesarea fell upon them and slaughtered them together with their wives and children, though they raised no hand in resistance. And this without the least regard even for the Romans themselves, who counted only those in revolt as their enemies. But someone will say that the people of Caesarea always had a quarrel with the Jews among them, and simply seized the occasion to satisfy an old hatred. What then shall we say of the people of Scythopolis? They dared to make war on us for the sake of the Greeks, rather than stand with our own kinsmen against the Romans, and much good their goodwill and loyalty toward the Greeks did them. They were butchered by them, whole households at once, and this was the reward they got for their alliance. The very harm they had kept the Greeks from suffering at our hands, they themselves suffered, exactly as they had once wished to inflict it. It would take too long now to go through each case individually, for you know that there is not one city in Syria whose resident Jews has never killed the Jews living within it, though we are enemies of Rome more than they are. Yet the people of Damascus, without even being able to invent a plausible pretext, filled their city with the foulest bloodshed, slaughtering 18,000 Jews together with their wives and children. As for Egypt, we hear that the number of those killed there with torture comes to something over 60,000. Those people, perhaps, died as they did on foreign soil, where they found no strength to match their enemies. But for us, who took up war against Rome on our own soil, did we lack anything that could have given a firm hope of victory? We had weapons, walls, fortresses built to resist capture, and a spirit unbending before the dangers we faced for freedom. All of these emboldened everyone toward revolt. But these advantages, sufficient for only a short time and raising our hopes, proved to be the beginning of greater evils. Everything was taken, everything fell to the enemy, as though it had all been prepared not for the safety of those who made it, but for the greater glory of their conquest. Those who died in battle deserve to be called fortunate, for they died defending themselves and never surrendering their freedom. But who could fail to pity the multitude who fell into Roman hands, who would not hurry to die rather than suffer what they suffered? Some of them died under torture, racked by fire and whips. Others, half eaten by wild beasts, were kept alive to be devoured a second time, providing laughter and sport for their enemies. Of those people, the most wretched must be reckoned the ones still alive, who have often prayed for death and cannot obtain it. And where is that great city now, the mother city of the whole Jewish nation, fortified by so many rings of walls, defended by so many strongholds and towers of such size, scarcely able to contain the preparations made for war, and holding so many tens of thousands of men who fought for her? Where has she gone, the city we believed had God himself as her founder? She has been torn up root and branch from her foundations, and the only monument left to her is the camp of her killers, still living among her ruins. Wretched old men sit by the ashes of the sanctuary, and a few women, kept alive by the enemy for the most shameful outrage. Who among us, weighing all this in his mind, could bear to go on looking at the sun, even if he could live free of danger? Who is so much an enemy of his country, or so unmanly and in love with his own life, as not to regret having lived until now? If only we had all died before we saw that holy city torn down by enemy hands, before we saw the sacred temple so impiously dug out of the ground. But since a hope not ignoble deceived us, that we might perhaps be able to avenge her against our enemies, and that hope has now vanished and left us alone in our extremity, let us hasten to die well. Let us have mercy on ourselves, on our children, and on our wives, while it is still in our power to receive mercy from our own hands. We were born for death, and so were the children we brought into the world, and even the most fortunate cannot escape it. But outrage and slavery, and the sight of our wives being led away to shame together with their children, these are not evils that nature forces upon men. Rather, men endure them through their own cowardice, when they refuse to die though death lay open to them beforehand. We, who prided ourselves greatly on our courage, revolted from Rome, and now, at the last, when they call us to come over and be saved, we have refused to obey them. Who then can fail to see plainly what their rage will be if they take us alive? Wretched will be the young men, whose bodily strength will hold out through many torments. Wretched too the old, whose age cannot bear such misfortunes. A man will watch his wife dragged off by force. He will hear his child's voice crying out for its father, his own hands bound. But while they are still free and still hold the sword, let them render us one last, noble service. Let us die unenslaved by our enemies and go out of life as free men, together with our children and our wives. This is what our laws command us. This is what our wives and children beg of us. God has sent this necessity upon us, and it is the very opposite of what the Romans want, for they are afraid that any of us might die before the city is taken. Let us hasten, then, to leave them, instead of the satisfaction they hope to gain over us, astonishment at our death and wonder at our courage. While he was still willing to go on urging them, all of them cut him short and rushed to the deed, filled with an irrepressible impulse, and went off as though possessed, each one eager to outstrip the other, thinking it a proof of courage and good judgment not to be seen among the last. So great was the passion that seized them for killing their wives, their children, and themselves. And indeed, contrary to what one might expect, they were not softened as they came to the act itself, but kept the same firm resolve they had held while listening to the speech, the natural affection of love for their families remaining with them all, while reason, having judged what was best, prevailed over their dearest attachments. For at one and the same moment they embraced their wives and took their children into their arms, clinging to them with final kisses and weeping. And yet, as though carried out by hands not their own, they went through with the plan, holding as their one consolation for the necessity of killing the thought of the evils they would suffer if they fell alive into enemy hands. And in the end, not one was found wanting in the face of so terrible a deed. All of them went through it with those closest to them, wretched in their necessity, men to whom killing their own wives and children with their own hands seemed the lightest of evils. Unable to bear the pain of what they had done any longer, and thinking it wrong to the dead to outlive them even a little while, they quickly gathered all their possessions into one heap and set fire to it. Then, choosing 10 men from among themselves by lot to be the killers of all the rest, each man lay down beside his wife and children as they lay dead, threw his arms around them, and offered his throat ready for the sacrifice to those charged with this miserable task. When these 10 had killed all the others without flinching, they fixed the same rule of lot among themselves, so that the one chosen should kill the other 9 and then, last of all, take his own life. All of them trusted each other so completely that neither in the doing nor in the suffering did one differ from another. In the end, 9 offered their throats, and the last man, the one alone remaining, surveyed the mass of the fallen to see whether, amid so much slaughter, anyone was still left needing his hand. And when he saw that all were dead, he set a great fire to the palace and drove his sword with his whole strength clean through his own body, falling beside his family. So they died, believing they had left nothing alive to fall into Roman hands. But an old woman and another woman, a relative of Eleazar, who surpassed most women in intelligence and learning, escaped notice by hiding in the underground channels that carried water, along with 5 children, while the others were absorbed in the killing. In all, the number that perished was 960, women and children included in the count. This tragedy took place on the 15th of the month of Xanthicus. The Romans, still expecting a fight, armed themselves at dawn and, bridging the approaches from their earthworks with gangways, launched an assault. Seeing none of the enemy, but on every side a terrible desolation, fire within, and silence, they were at a loss to make sense of what had happened, and finally shouted aloud, as if to draw out a volley, to see whether any of those inside would show themselves. The women heard the shouting, came up out of the underground channels, and reported to the Romans exactly what had happened, the one woman explaining clearly everything that had been said and how it had been carried out. The Romans found it hard to credit her at first, disbelieving the magnitude of the deed. They set about putting out the fire, and quickly cutting a path through it, made their way inside the palace. Coming upon the mass of the slain, they took no pleasure in it as they would over an enemy, but marveled at the nobility of their resolve and the utter disregard for death they had shown in carrying it out, unshaken amid so much suffering. After the fortress had been taken in this fashion, the general left a garrison there and himself withdrew with his forces to Caesarea. No enemy remained anywhere in the country. The whole land had at last, after the long war, been thoroughly subdued, giving even to many who lived far away a sense of the danger and disorder it had caused. Some time afterward, it also happened that many Jews died around Alexandria in Egypt. Those of the Sicarite faction who had managed to escape, they were not content simply to be safe. They set about stirring up new troubles again, persuading many of those who had taken them in to claim their freedom, to regard the Romans as no better than themselves, and to hold God alone as master. When some of the more prominent Jews opposed them, they killed some and pressed the rest, urging them toward revolt. Seeing their recklessness, the leading men of the council no longer thought it safe to overlook it. They gathered all the Jews into an assembly and denounced the madness of the Sicarii, declaring them responsible for all the troubles. They said that even now, since these men had no secure hope of safety even in flight, for they would be put to death at once if recognized by the Romans, they were involving those who had taken no part in their crimes in the disaster that properly belonged to them alone. They urged the people, therefore, to guard against ruin coming from these men, and to clear themselves before the Romans by handing them over. Recognizing the magnitude of the danger, the people were persuaded by what was said, and rushed upon the Sicarii with great violence, seizing them. Of these, 600 were captured at once. Those who fled into Egypt and to Thebes there were before long seized as well and brought back. In their case, there was no one who did not marvel at their endurance and at what one might call either their obstinacy or their strength of purpose. For though every kind of torture and bodily torment was devised against them, for this one purpose alone, that they should acknowledge Caesar as master, not one gave in or was even about to say it, but all of them kept their resolve superior to the compulsion laid upon them, receiving the tortures and the fire as though their bodies felt nothing, while their souls all but rejoiced. But it was above all the age of the children that astonished those who watched, for not one of them either could be compelled to call Caesar master. So far did the strength of their daring surpass the weakness of their bodies. Lupus, who then governed Alexandria, wrote at once to Caesar about this uprising. Caesar, suspicious of the Jews' unceasing propensity for revolution and fearing that they might again gather together in a body and draw others along with them, ordered Lupus to demolish the temple of the Jews called the Temple of Onias. This temple is in Egypt, and it came to be built, and got its name, for the following reason. Onias, son of Simon, one of the chief priests in Jerusalem, fleeing from Antiochus, the king of Syria, who was at war with the Jews, came to Alexandria. And since Ptolemy received him kindly, because of his own hostility toward Antiochus, Onias told him he could make the Jewish nation his ally, if he would be persuaded by what he had to propose. When the king agreed to do what he could, Onias asked to be allowed to build a temple somewhere in Egypt and to worship God according to the customs of his fathers. He argued that this would make the Jews still more hostile to Antiochus, who had pillaged their temple in Jerusalem, and would win their goodwill toward Ptolemy himself, drawing many of them to his side, free to practice their religion. Ptolemy, persuaded by these arguments, gave him a district 180 stadia from Memphis, in the nome called Heliopolite. There Onias built a fortress and constructed his temple, not like the one in Jerusalem, but resembling a tower, built of great stones and rising to 60 cubits. He modeled the design of the altar on that of the temple at home and adorned it in the same way with offerings, except for the construction of the lampstand. Instead of a lampstand, he had a golden lamp made and hung it by a golden chain, giving off its own light. The whole precinct was walled around with baked brick and had gates of stone. The king also granted a large tract of land for revenue, so that there would be abundance for the priests and ample means for the worship of God. Onias, however, did not act from a wholly sound motive in all this. He bore a grudge against the Jews of Jerusalem, remembering his anger at having been forced to flee, and thought that by building this temple he would draw the people away from them. There had also been an old prophecy, made some 600 years before, by a man named Isaiah, foretelling that this very temple would be built in Egypt by a Jewish man. Such, then, was the manner in which the temple came to be built. Lupus, the governor of Alexandria, upon receiving Caesar's letter, went to the temple, carried off some of the offerings, and closed it. After Lupus died shortly afterward, Paulinus, who succeeded him in the governorship, left none of the offerings behind, threatening the priests severely unless they brought out everything, and did not allow anyone wishing to worship to approach the precinct. He shut the gates and made it entirely inaccessible, so that not even a trace was left in the place of the service once offered to God. The time from the building of the temple to its closing came to 343 years. The madness of the Sicarii, like a disease, also touched the cities around Cyrene. A certain Jonathan, a most depraved man by trade a weaver, made his way there and persuaded a considerable number of the poor to follow him, leading them out into the desert and promising to show them signs and apparitions. After a thorough search was conducted throughout the whole region, he was caught and brought before the governor. There he tried every device to secure his own release from punishment, and in doing so gave Catullus an opening for wrongdoing. For Jonathan, lying, claimed that the wealthiest of the Jews had put him up to the plot, and Catullus eagerly seized on these accusations, building the affair up into something enormous with grand theatrical flourishes, so that he too might appear to have brought a Jewish war to a successful end. But worse than this, not only did Catullus believe the charges too readily, he actually became a teacher to the Sicarii in the art of lying. He ordered Jonathan to name a certain Jew, Alexander, with whom he had long been at odds and against whom he had openly declared his hatred, and to implicate that man's wife, Berenice, in the charges as well. These two he put to death first, and after them he slaughtered about 1,000 men distinguished by their wealth, thinking he could do this safely, since he was appropriating their property for Caesar's revenues. And so that no Jews elsewhere might be able to expose his injustice, he extended the lie still further, persuading Jonathan and some of those arrested along with him to bring a charge of sedition against the most eminent Jews of Alexandria and of Rome. One of those falsely accused in this conspiracy was Josephus, the author of this history. The scheme, however, did not turn out as Catullus had hoped. He came to Rome bringing Jonathan and his associates in chains, believing that the false accusations made against himself and through his agency would settle the matter once and for all. But Vespasian, suspecting the truth of the affair, investigated it, and on discovering that the charge brought against these men was unjust, released them from the accusations, Titus having urged this, and inflicted on Jonathan the punishment he deserved. He was burned alive after first being tortured. As for Catullus, at that time the emperor's clemency spared him from suffering anything worse than condemnation. But not long afterward, he was seized by a disease of many forms, hard to cure, and died a painful death. And it was not only his body that was afflicted, for the sickness of his soul was heavier still. He was thrown into terror by nightmares and cried out repeatedly that he saw before him the ghosts of those he had murdered, standing over him. Unable to control himself, he would leap from his bed as though torture and fire were being applied to him. As the disease steadily worsened, his bowels rotted away and fell out, and so he died, as clear a proof as any that the providence of God inflicts punishment on the wicked. Here I bring my history to its conclusion, the history which I promise to hand down with complete accuracy to those who wish to learn how this war was fought between the Romans and the Jews. As for how well it has been composed, I leave that to the judgment of my readers. But as to its truthfulness, I would not hesitate to declare with confidence that this alone has been my aim throughout the entire narrative.